C1SP. Number 17A.
So we come to the last subject, which really is the climax, and I would say the purpose of the whole second part. See, in the fifth subject, we saw that mortals evolve their own images of thought. That mortals evolve it. And that they evolve it not only consciously, but also involuntarily. That they build up, that mortal consciousness builds up involuntarily a universe of mortal thought and mortal experience, with all the catastrophe and the discord that such a mortal thought can bring about. And then she goes on and says, in truth, that mind readers can reproduce all whatever happened within that realm of mortal thought. That even that which has been forgotten, which has fallen down in the subconscious, that can be called back to consciousness. That the whole content, so to say, of mortal mind can be called back to consciousness. Well, I don't see much purpose in that. I don't see much purpose in that except for one purpose which he has shown as the purpose of mind reading, namely, when it is necessary to heal and to save and to help. But just to read and to bring back indiscriminately everything that ever happened within the realm of mortal thought, that is no divine purpose. That is what spiritualism and clairvoyance really does, and that's why it's so pernicious in its tendency. It's building up just the wrong universe instead of the right universe. It's bringing to life and to presence the wrong universe, the universe of mortal thought instead of the universe of the divine mind. And so the last subject comes in and brings now a solution and says, now, what is now real about this whole mortal mind reading and divine mind reading? What is real about this whole mortal concept and mortal universe? What now is the value of this universe of mortal beliefs? And so the seventh subject comes in and says, you know, only a mentality which is based on ideas, which is based on the divine mind and its ideas, only that is really wonderful. And all the rest of it, that is combined with recollecting forgotten sentences and smells and odors and so on, all that is not a wonder. That's just good enough for some performances on a stage. That's just good enough for inquisitive mortal mind, but that is not good enough for true men. So mentality which is based on mortal mind reading with all its so-called phenomena are no wonders at all, are no real wonders. She gives here, I think, a picture of what a real wonder is, what a real beauty of life is, compared with the imaginary wonders of mortal existence. How does she show that? And here we come to the basis of what we have seen quite right from the beginning, namely, that every phenomena, no wonder if it's wonderful to the senses or to the ignorant thought or not, that every phenomena must first be traced back to its cause. When we have traced it back to its cause and uncovered what the cause really is, then we can decide on its value. If that cause is mortal mind, then its value is always naught. But if its basis is divine mind, then its value is always positive and it's always a wonder of God, a gift of God. And so she builds up the subject first by showing in lover's mind that only from the divine mind emanate idea. That everything that has its cause, its origin in something besides divine mind, say in brain or in matter, that is an illusion. That is an illusion. Having made that clear, she goes on to love as spirit and says, and you know, the nature of an illusion is such, is always dual. The nature of an illusion is not so that it is, that it always shows its worst side. But the nature of an illusion is that it also can counterfeit the good. It says, you just excite the organ of veneration or religious faith, and the individual manifests profound adoration. But she says you can also excite the opposite development. See, it always is always dual, good and evil, an illusion. It's always both. And therefore, is never really good. That even if it appears as good as religious veneration, as profound adoration, that it really is not good. Because you can just as well exercise the opposite direction and it blasphemes, one of both, or perhaps the third one. And this is so true. You see, we see so often people, they are just so thrilled about the signs of Christian Science, so thrilled. If one isn't careful, one can be fooled by it, because that can just be an illusion, can just be the excitement of a religious faith which ends in religious adoration. And usually after a few years one just experiences the contrary of them, and everything is wrong about it. It's not sober. Whereas an idea can only be developed in one direction, always in good. And that usually is more sober and more steady. Then she goes on and says, and this development can bring forth certain phenomena. And she takes as an example eloquence, and shows the phenomena of eloquence, and shows that this phenomena must be first analyzed down to its origin again in order to see if that eloquence is really a divine wonder, a gift of love, or if it is just another trick of mortal mind. She says that eloquence shows the possibility derived from mind. It means divine mind. Oh yeah, she says so. It's the possibility derived from divine mind. And that eloquence is due to inspiration and can re-echo the strains of truth and love. Now, let's see how, you see, she shows you very clearly this phenomena of eloquence as one out of a thousand of other examples which you could have taken. And shows the basis of it, the cause of it, and says it's the divine mind. But she also shows the effect of it. It re-echoes what? The strains of truth and love. That eloquence is always concerned with God and God's universe, based on divine mind. Well, that's a real wonder. That's the demonstration and that's the beauty of science and of God. It re-echoes, such eloquence which is based on the divine mind does not re-echo all the Babylon and babble on of the Babylonian belief. That eloquence is not the Babylon of the Babylon. That is something. Yes.
That's clever.
Yes, that's clever. That's eloquence. That only re-echoes the strains of truth and love, you see. It talks about the divine reality. Then she takes the same phenomena and shows that it can also have another cause. It can be, that says that it can be the gift of obtained from books through learning. We can learn, work, and work hard, and work even harder until we have a certain measure of eloquence. But then the cause is not divine mind. And then, as she shows afterwards, that such a tutored eloquence will never be able to interpret the beauty of principle, but can only re-echo what one has learned from the books, can no more re-echo truth and love. And then she takes a third phase or possibility and shows that eloquence can also come from so-called spirits or one's own beliefs. You know, we know that in spiritualistic seances somebody can become very eloquent which has not been eloquent in the usual way. And we know from hypnotism that somebody can suddenly begin to talk Chinese who has never heard Chinese. See, where does that eloquence come from? Is it also a wonder of God? Is it also re-echoing truth and love? Is it also from the divine mind? The unillumined thought would say, well, that's something supernatural, that's something quite fabulous, that suddenly somebody in a trance can speak a language which they've never heard. And so again, science must come and dispel all mystery and must explain extraordinary phenomena. And we see, just as other mind reading, that the moment the beliefs are loosened, that the mortal limited beliefs are loosened and is exchanged for another belief, namely the belief in the possibility of eloquence, that then it is just exchanging one belief for another. That the belief in the impossibility and inability is exchanged in a belief of ability and possibility. Spiritualists say it is a spirit that does it. Hypnotists say it is my mortal mind influence that say it. Both are really the same. Both are beliefs. And so she traces here, you see, the same phenomena, the same outward phenomena called eloquence. She traces it back and analyzes it and shows that there are three very different things, different in origin and different in purpose. Well, that's something we have to remind ourselves. Because so often we see phenomena of all sorts of things, unusual things of which we are not accustomed, I have never heard of, never seen of, and so on. And the moment the human mind sees something which he has not known before, says, well, that's a wonder. Well, what sort of wonder is it? Is it the wonder of delusion, or is it the wonder of God? And to decide on that, we can only by tracing it back to lover's mind. Because of lover's mind, she said, what is the origin? If it's the origin is divine mind, then it's an idea and then it's always wonderful. If the origin is just a mortal belief, an excited belief, then its phenomena is always elusive and delusive. And so she goes on and says, really, in lover's principle, she shows that really, only that which is based on the divine mind, which is not dependent on educational processes, on tutoring, on erudition, that if we fall back on the divine mind, we fall back on a source which is full, which possesses of itself all beauty and poetry and the power of expressing them. I haven't yet talked in poetry up to now. You see, it shows if we fall back on the divine mind and contrary know that we should speak and be inspired by filling our thought with the one mind, then spirit silences the material senses. Then the material senses get slowly out of the way, and the divine mind can speak through the medium, through the true mediumship of spiritual sense. And of that spiritual sense, she says, that soul confers then a freedom, gives another freedom than spiritualism, which just loosens the belief into wild freedom. It gives here a true freedom, which explains the phenomena of improvisation and the fervor of untutored lips, See, it shows that the divine principle speaks through mind, spirit, soul, in an untutored way. I think we have to remind that very much when we speak about science, give a talk on science, that we are not speaking through a tutored process, that we have not learned by heart or through lots of notes and so on what we shall say, but that all that is a preparatory work which is, has only one purpose, to bring us in line with the one mind. And the more we bring ourselves mentally, in our mentality, one with the divine mind, and are willing to let a mortal channel, a material channel, be dropped and put aside, the more spiritual sense has a free channel to speak through it, and the freer we become to say what God wants to say and interpret what the divine principle wants to interpret, and not what we humanly would like to say and to speak. And then she goes on and shows that out of this infinite interpretation of the divine principle really flows life, truth and love. And she gives three more passages which are a bit difficult insofar as I feel it's difficult to speak about it, because I have never demonstrated anything near to what she says here. And then when one has that feeling, one better shuts up. And yet, just for the sake of seeing the whole picture, we always can speak about it in a visionary way, because it shows the end, the final purpose of this second part. It shows that what we know from other experience, really, that only that which we draw from the divine principle is life. And so here she says that in scientific inspiration really is the real source of life, that in that is divine origination, that in scientific interpretation originates the multiplication of life, while matter cannot originate life. She says, well, who has created the tree? Has the tree brought forth the tree? Has the sound brought forth music? Has a man created man? What is the first origin? What was first, really, the egg or the bird? See, and showing that we have to see that this again is a sense of spiritualism, namely of the belief of life in matter, to think that every living thing comes out of a material embryo or origin. Whereas the true fact is, and I think in some way we have demonstrated that, that we see that if we go back to the Father. Life is always that which says, I go back to the Father. I come from the Father and I go to the Father. And in the measure as we go back to the Father, to that principle which is life, which is mind, spirit, soul, if I go back to that principle and sit at the throne of grace, to the right hand of God, that then from that point I begin to interpret the universe, and what I begin to see from that standpoint is really originative, is really true originative. That what I begin to see from that really originates something divinely. And in some measure we have done that. In some measure, you know, in some measure we have seen the signs of Christianity. And in some measure, seeing that signs of Christianity, we were willing to go the way. And we were seeing new ways and new purpose in life, and were originating a new purpose in life, really. But fundamentally, it shows that this life is spiritual, and that it is never material, and that we would one day we have to demonstrate that. Tenji goes on and says, and to love as truth, and would say that if we would also see that there is no substance in matter, we really would see that there is no substance in matter, then we could control and dominate our body in this truly and really. She says, just as the divine mind upholds the revolutions and rotations of the earth, of the material body earth, though this earth is not standing on a material orbit, that the orbit of the earth is only imaginary, that therefore the earth is not resting on something substantial, the divine mind holds the earth in its orbit. And she says, in the same way, if we would see that there is really no substance in the body, then the divine mind could do with that body the same thing. It could, how does she say, that motions and the movement and transitions now possible for mortal mind would be found equally possible for the body. Now, Jesus proved that. Jesus proved that on the lake Gennesaret, you say? Gennesaret? See, that he proved that the transition of his body was just as quick as the transition of mortal mind. That he could walk over the sea much quicker than the disciples could row over. That immediately he was on the other side with his body. See, just as divine mind maintains the rotations and the movements of the earth, of the body earth, just so if we would see that there is no substance, no reality in this body, then we could move this body just as quickly as we do it in thinking, in mortal mind. In mortal mind, actually, we can do that. You know that very well. You just fall asleep, and with your body you are in California, and the next moment, the next second, you are with your body in China or anywhere else, and the next second you are back in your bed. But the body doesn't move. Only your mortal mind moves. And it is, she says here, why doesn't the body go? The onlooker sees the body still in your bed, while your mortal mind walks all around the earth. And she says, the reason is that we still believe that that matter is substance. And if we would lose that belief, of which is really spiritualistic, you see, that matter is substantial, if we would lose that belief, then the transitions would be, for the body would just be as easily as for mortal mind. And then lastly, she shows that the so-called wonders of mortal mentality are delusions. She says, now you see, in our dreams, or the opium and hashish eater, they have wonderful dreams. They work wonders in their dreams. You know, they can do all sorts of things. They are so happy. They feel like in heaven. That's why they like to smoke again and take again opium and so on, because they are just wonderful in their dreams. But what's wonderful about in their dreams? They are just as miserable as ever before and become even more miserable every day. Only in their mortal mind they are wonderful. Well, to be wonderful in mortal mind is not very difficult. To be wonderful in mortal mind is the easiest thing. You just have to drink too much or to take some opium and you are it. And so she says, you see what mortal mind really is, what the wonders of so-called mortal mind is. Here is an example how it is. It's just a big delusion. It's not a wonder. It's not a wonder. It would be a wonder if instead of relying to mortal mind, we would always go back to the divine mind. Because the side note there is, and I think it's one of the most important side notes in this whole chapter, mind is substance, divine mind, the mind, capital M, is substance. That's the substance. If really we would see that mind, the divine mind is substance, you see, that the divine mind constitutes our whole identity, then in that mind really we would be universal. Then in that mind we would not be fettered and rigid as the mortal body is. But in the divine mind we are universal, we are every place at every time. And so she closes this subject with this point. You see, Jesus demonstrated these things. See, if we take, for instance, those passages from the Gospels, where he just first demonstrated the proposition of love as principle, for instance, when he went into the desert and the whole multitude followed him, and he had a wonderful long interpretation of principle. He had that eloquence which was able to interpret the divine principle from morning to night, and the multitude listened to him, and he was talking to them in a full eloquence, but inspired by principle. Then he demonstrated that point of love as life by the multiplication of the loaves and the fishes. He wasn't asking, do I have a mortal origin, life in matter, to bring about multiplication. He had no wheat to bake bread. He had no, you call it monad for the fishes, you see. He brought it forth through the inspiration of life. He saw, you see, that life has its origin in spirit, in the divine mind, not in matter. And so could, against, in spite of the mortal testimony, produce the loaves and the fishes. Then after the feeding of the multitude, he went into the mountain. The disciples took a boat, they rowed over the Sea of Gennesaret. In the middle of it, they had a storm. Jesus was there at once and helped them out. And immediately, they were on the other side. See, he demonstrated here the love as truth, showing that because he didn't believe in the belief of substance in matter, but he had an understanding of the substance of divine mind, the transitions were as easily for the body as for the divine mind. And then being there on the other side, it's shown that they brought to him all sorts of sick people, and he healed them. He changed the body. You see, he changed the body. Whereas here it is shown mortal mind also does wonders. In mortal mind we always say, yes, that can be healed by Christian Science, and in mortal mind we are very good practitioners, and we confess to Christian Science that it can do this one and that one. In mortal mind it's very easy, but to demonstrate it, that's another point. And she shows that demonstration is only be done when we see that the divine mind is substance, and that there is no substance in matter. So Jesus did demonstrate all those points which Mrs. Eddy explains here as the principle of wonders. And this gives us the certainty and the assurance that in principle this whole thing is just right and just clear and just natural, but that we have to work it out, each individual by himself. But that we can't work it out through a belief. That in belief it's very easy to be wonderful. Just as it is very easy in a dream to be wonderful. But in reality to be wonderful, that's another question.